Welcome in, folks. We are live with Vinnie Eastwood from the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Vinnie, are you there?
I am indeed.
This is good to hear. This is a live simulcast on live365.com. And it is a unique thing for the In Wish Out Show because we haven't done this with anyone before, especially Vinnie. So welcome aboard, Vinnie. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Well, you know, it's a bit of a simulcast. So as well as welcoming you, ladies and gentlemen, to the In Wish Out Show, we're also welcoming you to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. This suddenly feels really right to me. I was actually just arguing with a whole bunch of people from the Kiwi Journalists Association, Ian, and they're all like really arrogant and like abusive and things like this. Anybody talks about anything to do with world government conspiracy or the climate change hoax or anything really that's real, you get abused for. And I was like, these are the people that are calling themselves journalists. And somebody asked me, what is the pinnacle? What are you actually really trying to do in terms of journalism? And I thought to myself, you know, I guess the idea should be to balance credibility and morality. And I couldn't think of any person who personifies more than that, not in this country, in the New Zealand field, than yourself, Ian.
That's very kind of you, Vinnie. Yeah, it's a big issue, I think, for journalism, basically. I'm not sure that we have our game quite right yet as a profession.
Although you could be would be surprised that a lot of people within the profession certainly don't agree with you.
Yeah, well, I think the problem is this. I think that journalism has turned from a profession which it used to be into being an agenda-driven profession that sees itself as part of the establishment, virtually the marketing arm of the establishment, and the movement between journalism and PR these days is so wide that this sort of is an illustration, I think, of the problem that we face, because journalists are moving back and forth from news to PR, politics, left, right, and centre. Just look at the Shane Taurima controversy. Here he was standing for Labor, or trying to stand for Labor, didn't make it, went back to news, ends up running Labor Party political meetings from within TVNZ's building. They should have seen that one coming.
Well, and also there's MediaWorks. What was his name? Stephen Joyce was CEO of MediaWorks, and then he becomes the government communication minister and then brokers, like, what was it, a $30 or $40 million bailout in unpaid broadcasting fees that MediaWorks couldn't afford because the advertisers can't be bothered advertising with them because nobody watches them because they suck. All right, that's my interpretation. I could be wrong.
Yeah, the cynic in you. I mean, look, I think the problem with my fellow journalist is this. They see themselves as evangelists for various ideas and theories, and they go out there and they print this stuff unquestioningly. You look at their stand on vaccination, on fluoride, on food additives, a range of things that the media should be far more questioning about, and they're just not.
Incidentally, one of them objected to me posting a video of Dr. Laurie Brett, who's a fairly well-known dentist in this country up in Whangarei, who's amazing credibility when it comes to questioning the science behind fluoride or the lack thereof. And what one of these journalists criticized me for is putting up his version, Dr. Laurie's version, and not counterbalancing it with the mainstream version. My perspective was that if you're going to be covering something that the mainstream isn't, cover that, because all of the rest of it's done. Okay, if people want to be propagandized about the false benefits of fluoride, we have the Ministry of Health cracking down on everybody, we have the media in everybody's back pockets, they don't need any help propagating their propaganda. The people speaking out against it, on the other hand, those are the only people that I'm interested in helping. Otherwise, what's the point, Ian?
Well, that's one of the criticisms that I've always faced from my colleagues in the media, because Investigate magazine has done some pithy stories over the years, and we're accused of being one-sided in terms of politics. But I've said to them, look, I'm playing a long game here, because if you go back to the 1990s and the Winebox investigation, the Paradise Conspiracy, that sort of thing, National was in power, and they got a bollocking from Investigate magazine. Labor came into power after that, and that was the era of Investigate, and they got a bollocking from Investigate magazine. National are back in power, and we have criticised them on a number of fronts and have certainly not been fulsome in support. The Daylight Robbery book featuring John Key on the front cover is just an example of, you know, questioning again the wisdom of asset sales. We are there to question whoever is in power without fear or favour. And I think that's what my colleagues in the media forget. They become wedded to the politics, as in Shane Tyrima again. They wear their political colours on their sleeves, and they forget that they're journalists first and foremost rather than evangelists for whatever political belief that they hold. And this is where our profession is running aground, because a lot of the journalists who are in practice don't disclose their political beliefs, but their political beliefs govern how they write their stories. And that's a problem, because the public see no transparency.
It's editorializing under the guise of journalism, isn't it, to a large extent?
That's exactly right, yeah.
Well, this inherently, to me, is a conflict of interest, I think, and also there's the element of can you run a successful journalism business in this country? Can you actually make enough money to survive based purely on reporting the truth? Now, if you want to make large quantities of money, I'm not sure if that's entirely possible. You can't become a multimillionaire by only telling the truth, because ultimately many of the power brokers in this country and many others who are holding much of the finances and at bay and what have you are the ones who are more likely to be advertising on television and what have you, and certainly would withdraw their funding if their business interests were threatened by a little something called the truth.
Yeah, this is right, and I think we are a testimony to exactly this problem. If you look at Investigate magazine, when it started off, we had more readers than Metro magazine currently has. We had absolutely no advertising agency support because we were seen as politically incorrect. They didn't like our flavour of the truth. So although we're a glossy magazine with a big readership, we did not get supported. It was just actively discouraged. When the Labor government was in power, they made sure that their advertising agency handed out contracts to all the media who were favourable, and none of the media who had ever criticised Labor got advertising contracts for various government agencies that were doing big ad campaigns through the 2000s. So we certainly weren't making money from advertising. That meant that we as a magazine had to rely entirely on our readership and subscriber base to make money. And you don't become a millionaire off that. And then you get people who say, oh, well, all the hard work you're doing, you work for 6 months or 12 months on an investigation, and quite frankly, you should give it out for free because we think we deserve to hear it for free. And there's this mentality within the public. So you're caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, really, because the people with the money, the power brokers, won't pay you. And the public are not willing to pay for investigative journalism in some cases. So where do you go?
I noticed that problem myself, and what I did is I tried to find a target market. My target market is people who have woken up to the truth about the world government, how more or less most of what we're raised to believe isn't true, and the people who have fallen into that without a catch net. Psychologically speaking, it's actually incredibly traumatic to have your current view of reality warped, as it were, to the point where you almost don't believe anything the establishment says anymore. Your whole life falls apart. That's my target audience, those people who are in that state of trauma, who want to have a few laughs and be able to survive. That's basically it. And I find if I do it for them for free, they appreciate it and watch it. And if I ask for donations, they give them to me when I need them, and only as much as I need. That's what I found very interesting. It doesn't matter how much I ask for, I'll only get exactly enough to pay the bills, which to me is quite synchronistic in a way. I recall one morning I was waking up stressed because I had my rent due, my car needed to be fixed, and you know all of these other general expenses that people with a 9-to-5 regular paycheck and what have you are a bit of a pain. But for somebody who doesn't have that regular income, it can be actually incredibly stressful to live under. And I calculated it in my head while I was walking from my bedroom to my computer to start work, And I said, I needed about $500. So I went to my PayPal, and there was an exact $500 donation sitting in there by one of my listeners. You know, I think it's when you're doing the right thing, the universe shows up to support you in some way. Maybe it's a divinity. I'm not 100% sure. All I know is that I'm grateful both to my listeners and for the fact that I get to do the right thing and I don't hurt people in the way that I make money.
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly you know, working towards a model. I mean, with Investigate Magazine, of course, we do the magazine. We have the book publishing company. We've branched out, as listeners to the show now know, into radio on live365.com. And that's different ways of reaching people. I guess, you know, like you, we too find that we have enough to pay the bills and you know, we have enough to market our products. We're certainly not, you know, made of money. We live an average lifestyle and work hard, work very hard. But I think for me, the real issue is the passion behind the work, because I'm not doing it to become a millionaire. And I guess that was the other part of my story.
Yeah, yeah.
I could have easily changed the way that I covered things in order to become more commercial. Could have done that with a snap of the fingers, just like that. And I would have made a fortune, but it would have sold my soul.
Is that really what we're talking about here, is that those journalists who don't make that choice to become independent and to report the truth, regardless of what it really cost them, are they actually selling their souls in and of itself to do that? And if so, how can they get them back once they've gone to that?
Look, I think it's wider than journalism.
Yeah.
If you read Totalitaria, the essence of that book is that we have been indoctrinated now for decades to effectively subconsciously be prepared for the coming world government regime. That world government regime has a number of commandments that it wants people to believe in. And those commandments are being taught in our school systems, in our universities, in social media conversations. People are just being indoctrinated left, right, and center. The journalists come through that education process the same as everybody else. The journalism courses are as guilty as everybody else of indoctrinating young journalists into these belief systems. They don't even know they're doing it. They can't even see that their worldview is corrupting their independence. So we now have a society that is effectively feeding on itself and breaking down. We're losing the ability to think critically. We're losing the ability to have a sensible debate. And this is one of the things that we're trying to provoke with, you know, everything that we're doing.
You know, it's interesting you should use the word provoke, because that's actually what I feel like doing a lot of the times. I mean, I've never been trained in journalism. I've never actually worked in the industry, although I have spoken to many people within it, people who have left it and that kind of thing. And I recall something you told me, I think it might have been even a couple of years ago when I was first starting my show, Ian, that you thought that the, what was it, TVNZ blondes, you said, or that the journalists or airheads, it just occurred to me that you don't actually need to be that bright in this society in order to be respected. You don't even need to be respectful of your readership. In fact, one of the... excuse me. I think it was Diana Clement, I think. I'm not sure if you've heard of her, but she's one of the admins of that Kiwi Journalists Association. And she told me in a message as she was trying to vet me to come into this group in the first place that this group was not for the great unwashed. Now, just that term, the great unwashed, it just smacked to me like she thought she was better than everybody else. And sure enough, when going into the group, the attitude of the other journalists as well seemed to do that. And it occurs to me that this is how the hierarchy actually works. If you get a whole bunch of people in together who think they're better than everybody else, they think it's perfectly justified, even in the face of massive hypocrisy, to act terribly to other people. It reminds me of the the Harvard jailing study, I think, where they dressed up students as prisoners and students as guards. And after a very short period of time, because the students who were the prisoners had no power whatsoever, they started getting abused and taken advantage of by those with the power. And I think that's how this society is kind of running, like champagne glass pyramids, really.
Well, if you look at the book Totalitaria again, the book documents a secret society that wants to control the planet and control politics and control a whole bunch of things. And they've been very successful at doing it, and the book lays out exactly what they've got away with. And they too have this attitude that there's a difference between the great unwashed, the general public as we know them, and the initiates. The initiates, the experts, the top of the tree will know everything, but the great unwashed will know nothing, be led carefully and calmly by the nose and directed to believe in certain things, but we can't expect too much of them because they're basically ignorant. And this is in the book, the phrasing of these documents, that the contempt with which they hold the ordinary people. And they say they have little minds and they can't really know much at all. Therefore, we shouldn't stress them with the details. We'll just take control. And that's what they proceeded to do. I mean, our schooling system, as I said, our schooling system, our social services, they've all been tainted by this stuff. And so we're seeing effectively, Mogadon-type people popping up everywhere.
Sorry, you might have to define...
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
You might have to define Mogadon for me.
Mogadon, yeah, who remembers Mogadon? Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, it's like the soul is missing from these people. Their minds are just, they've lost the ability to think for themselves. They just follow whatever mantra they've been given to hum.
That sounds actually like I've interviewed a Freemason whistleblower. In fact, I was speaking with him just this evening, in fact, and he was telling me about how all of these degrees and things that they're trying to lead people into is more or less very slowly ripening the initiate's soul up for demon possession. And I think, you know, you look at some of these people in our society who do these terrible things, and I don't think they're really human, you know. There's something human missing from them. And I'm talking about the elite specifically, the very, very high up people. Something's been lost in their humanity and can't return.
This is something that, again, I'm going to labour the point because it's a really important point. The book Totalitaria has documented this issue of who wants to take over the planet. And just to put this in context, there's been plenty of attempts to rule the world over the centuries, as we all know. But the technical ability to do that has only existed in the present day. You know, previous attempts were done by brute force or conquest, and quite frankly, no matter how hard the Romans tried, they couldn't really administer the entire planet, and they didn't. At their peak, they only covered 4% of the globe. The Nazis covered 4% of the globe at their peak. The two biggest empires the world has seen were the Mongols, who, of course, had lots of land to play with, and they covered 21% of the planet, and the British Empire, which covered 24% at its peak. But even the British, where the sun never set on empire, could not avoid the issue of, well, you can't really control New Zealand in real time from London. Today, with the technology that we now have, that's changed.
So I think the point of Totalitaria to stress to those who will be readership, and if you're listening to this and you're not planning on reading the book, heaven help you. But the point here is, if you want to fight for liberty, if you actually want freedom, this isn't just your chance. This is your last chance. Once the system is in, once it is locked in, it will be irresistible, like Tina Turner.
Exactly, or Robert Palmer, or whatever it is that sings that song. Look, it is very much like that. Now, I think Totalitaria, you know, for all of the people who hate Ian Wishart as a brand, they need to get off their moral high horse and read the book, because the issue is, this is a real plan to take over the world. And the issue I've got with that is that I'm just getting interruptions outside the window. There's a bunch of cows. The neighbor's cows have invaded the driveway. I sound distracted. That's why. Reading the dailies.
I can rant for a few minutes here, and if you want to go check on them, though,
go chase them. Look, I'll play some music. I can see them heading for the. They're getting into all sorts of damages to anyway. I'll be back in just a moment.
Okay. Right. Well, I think as and what is kind of trying to say is that the book Totalitaria is at least the parts that I've read of it. I haven't managed to read through the entire thing. I'm not much of a reader. I'm sorry, but the point here is, as I said, it's simply irresistible. And I think what you have to realize, and I don't want to condescend or tell you anything that you don't know. You're probably my elders and wiser than I am. I've looked at the demographics for these kind of shows, and everybody tends to be twice my age, usually far more qualified than I have and more life experience. However, because all of those kind of people are my friends and listeners, I've accumulated their knowledge without earning it. So let me just proceed. The life that you think that you've been living your entire existence, oh man, I'm feeling it sounding really arrogant here, isn't what you think it is, okay? And the people who you may have ever looked up to, those people who you put on a pedestal, will disappoint you. This is the way the system has been set up, so that those who you love, honor, try to be part of and what have you, are actually involved usually in a scheme themselves, if not by their own volition, by their brainwashing. How do you know if you're brainwashed? If you never question whether or not you're being brainwashed. Okay? That's simple. And one of my listeners today sent me a message hurriedly. He was very freaked out. He works for the tax department. And he was concerned, and I think this is actually a good lesson for all of us, he was concerned that because he saw scumbaggery happening all around him, and it's been happening for so long, he used to talk about it, he used to try and bring issue with it, and keep getting shouted down, and now what's happening is when he sees the scumbaggery around him, he doesn't mind so much, and he had a crisis of conscience, and he was like, oh my God, I don't actually mind the scumbaggery anymore. Am I a scumbag? And I said to him, no, you're not. Because if you were a scumbag, it would never occur to you, oh my God, I'm a scumbag. The same way it would never occur to somebody who was brainwashed, oh my God, I'm brainwashed. Because as soon as you make the realization, the second you make it, the brainwashing and all those conditionings and everything come off. It is just as important to expose the scumbaggery within yourself as it is to expose the scumbaggery within the government or the media or any of these other X amount of institutions which are all inexorably controlled by the same group of sociopathic scumbaggery that control the whole planet. Anyway, my question to you, the listeners, and I want you to think about this. Are you doing enough? No, seriously, think about this for a moment. Think about it long and hard and honestly. Are you doing enough to prevent the spread of scumbaggery? Scumbaggery is all-encompassing, sure, but we're all putting up with it to an extent, aren't we? We're all compromised. I'm still paying rent. I'm still paying power bills. You all are. There's no way out of this system. They've got us by the short and curlies.
They've grabbed you by your scumbag. That's what they've done.
Yeah. And and my question to the audience is, are they doing enough? And if you lose that self-analysis, am I doing enough? Have I become a scumbag unwittingly? Am I brainwashed? Those kind of self-analysis is incredibly important for your longevity if you are actually going to oppose these kind of forces by which assail us.
Yeah, well, if I can go back to the issue of totalitarian and the plan for world government, after being distracted by the Frisians. The book basically sets out this, that in the 1870s, a group, a secret society, believing that they had a divine mission, set out a plan to seize control of the future of the world. They infiltrated Buddhism. They set up the New Age movement. They infiltrated the Catholic Church, the Protestant Church. They infiltrated the United Nations. All of this is documented. It's covered in UN documentation. It's covered in autobiographies, some books long out of print. but they had a very clear plan, a very clear agenda. And the issue with that is these people believe they are supernaturally governed, and the world government that they want to impose is going to have that flavour. So if you think life is interesting now, it's going to get a hell of a lot more interesting if this happens.
I found this funny because a few people have used that word interesting in this context, and by interesting they mean totally messed up, bro.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, you people would get up in arms if they thought that there was going to be a born-again fundamentalist Christian administration running the country, let alone the world.
They've gotten up in arms just at the mention that one's trying to run for parliament.
Exactly. This is the thing. And yet, if you go to the other extreme, there's a mad bunch of New Age sympathisers who seriously think that they can usher in the return of the coming one, the absolute supreme, if they raise planetary vibrations enough, and they've seized on climate change and world governance as the way to do this. And it's just bizarre. But the problem is that we're not talking about fringe people here. We're talking about Secretaries General of the United Nations. These are people who are seriously in control of the planet. They have massive budgets to work with. And they've got a lot of the politicians of the world on side.
Well, I think the closest any of these people are going to come to the Supreme is when they go to Pizza Hut for dinner tonight.
Yeah, well, the point I make in the book is this. You don't have to believe in the religious supernatural stuff that these people believe in. It doesn't actually matter what you believe if you read totalitarian. You can be an atheist, you can be a skeptic, you can be a whatever. The point is this. The people who are in power and who have this agenda believe this. And that makes them very dangerous.
That's true. I mean, think what you will of Muslim extremism and the false terrorism kind of aspects that are coming out of it, and just basically being as an excuse to surveil everybody. It doesn't matter whether or not you believe in Muslim extremism. What matters is whether or not they are willing to blow you up. Okay.
Yeah. This is exactly right. And in fact, in the book, I quote some documents. These people who have this agenda that I'm talking about, the world government agenda, their belief is that they can only unite humanity and institute the brotherhood of man and world government if they create a new world religion. They see Christians, Muslims and Jews as problematic to that. And so they're doing everything they can to stir up trouble between those three religions, particularly Christianity and Islam, with the idea that if they stir up fundamentalists at either extreme, then the population of the world will come to hate Christians and Muslims generally, which will make the job of the world government people even easier because it gives them another manufactured crisis to solve. It's just divide and rule, and the public need to wake up to that.
I had a realization the other day. In fact, this is when I was smoking. I was like, oh, my God. There's like a couple of the most discriminated against peoples nowadays. It used to be people were discriminated against by race or sexuality and what have you, but now that's not really happening at all. Racism's kind of on its way out. Gay marriage has been legalized. You know, anybody says anything like that in public, you get chastised more or less. But if you're a smoker, you get cast out like a leper. If you're a conspiracy theorist, people back away very, very slowly from you.
And, well, yeah, but if you're a conspiracy factualist, they stay and listen.
Allegedly. You know, I've tried to lay facts on people, but they argue that there's no such thing as facts. And I think this is another part of the genius of this new world religion is solipsism. Nothing exists except me. Everything that I see around me, everything that I see, taste, touch, or smell is my own mind's creation, and I am responsible for all of it. All right? Yeah. My consciousness governs the entire world and voids the other 7 billion people's consciousness. How freaking insane is that?
That's bizarre. But again, this is symptomatic of the problem that we have. This is why this new religion is going to appeal to the public, because It has no judgment. It demands nothing of its followers except blind obedience to political correctness. And it makes everyone sing from the same hymn sheet. That's the way the world government people see it. They see religion as the ultimate opiate of the masses and the way of controlling the masses. You know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are divided on the issue of climate change. I can tell you, having researched the scientific papers, and I labour this point time and time again, the scientific evidence on climate change is very mixed. There is a huge debate taking place behind the scenes on whether you can even detect any human influence on climate at all at the moment. The planet's been cooling down for the last 10, 12 years. And our CO2 emissions have been increasing at a rate of knots over that time. So there's no direct correlation between CO2 and planetary temperatures. However, climate change was decided on as a major issue back in the early 1970s by the World Governance Group, who said we need to create environmental concerns that will unite the people behind it and give us a reason to impose new legislation and new laws effectively to save the planet, but with the mechanism of creating this world governance structure. This has been on the agenda for at least 40 years.
You're and talking about the Club of Rome documents.
The Club of Rome documents, the environment conference at Stockholm, all of these things
the Rio
are
Summit.
Mechanisms yeah. of the same outfit. And look, you know, if without giving the game away, the totalitarian book outlines this in absolute gory detail, but the point that I'm making, and this is directly related to your comments a second ago, is about facts. There are a million people out there who are listening to this saying, wish out just another conspiracy theory. There are 500 footnotes in that book referenced back to UN documents, New Zealand government documents, American government documents, autobiographies written by the officials and the people involved. I have gone to the nth degree to nail down every alleged conspiracy theory and turn it into a conspiracy fact. It's not really conspiracy because a conspiracy is something that takes place hidden. This agenda is hidden in plain sight. It's always been there if you're smart enough to know where to find it. Sadly, most people have been indoctrinated to not recognize it. I was reminded, I was speaking at a function last night, and I used this anecdote. Many of you will have watched the TV series The Following, and TVNZ ran a promo for that a couple of weeks ago, and the promo tagline from the show itself said this: the smartest thing the devil ever did was convince the world he didn't exist. And by blinding the population to a sector that actually is trying desperately to control them, it's almost like the Star Wars movie. These are not the droids you're looking for. It's old Obi-Wan's mind control tricks are underway here. The public, the media, they are blind to what is coming towards them. People who've read Totalitaria are waking up big time. It's like taking the red pill in the Matrix and finding out what's going on behind down the rabbit hole. It really is like that. And that's the reaction I'm getting. I mean, we had a big interview on George Norrie's show, Coast to Coast AM, just before Christmas. And, you know, he puts both of us to shame. 4 million listeners simultaneously to that show.
Actually, it's he's got between 19 and 29 million listeners, give or take about 400 to 500 affiliates. He's the number two talk radio show host in America, just beyond Rush, just underneath Rush Limbaugh, who's number one. He's number two. Rush. So yeah,
and it's staggering, and the impact of that, I think, is that Americans I've read more about Totalitaria than New Zealanders have. But the book is there, and as all the reviews are coming in and saying is, well, you know, regardless of whether it sounds all spooky, there's the documents. This is the agenda. It's there in plain sight. You can see what the Pope did in 1965. You can see what this crowd did. You can see what the Freemasons did. You can see what all these other secret societies got involved in and did right up to the present day. You can see what their agenda is, how they've written the education policies for New Zealand and America and Britain and Australia and Canada, specifically to condition the public to believe in their new regime. And this is a really, really dangerous thing. Totalitarian is a weapon for anybody who reads it, because it is like taking the red pill. It's like, wake up, smell the coffee. This is life-changing stuff for you. Now, naturally, the powers that be don't like me. But that's just, you know, goes with the territory, I guess.
Well, I also have this other thing, and I wanted to ask you if this has ever happened. I know that you're kind of like mature and well reserved and stuff like this, but every now and again, the denial and the brainwashing of other people and the abuse that they give me for trying to save their ass frustrates me so that I scream and I yell and I get really enraged and so on and so forth before eventually calming down again and going back to work. Has this happened to you?
Yeah, it is a frustrating process. It really is. You feel like bashing your head against the wall and just going, "Bleh," because you can't lead a horse to water and force it to drink. It is frustrating because the knowledge is there at their fingertips if they would only look and see. Sadly, a lot of people are so hung up on their own mentality, their own intellect, that they refuse to consider other arguments. Now, one of the things that I've been conscious of as a journalist is that I like to keep my friends close and my enemies closer because I don't believe that I can do a decent job as an investigative journalist in actually uncovering and debating an issue in this story if I don't fully appreciate the argument that my opponents are making, regardless of how much I like them or not. And that means that, for example, when I did the book The Divinity Code on the existence of God, I read in depth all the books by Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and John Spong and Karen Armstrong and the like on their views about the existence of God and the evolution process and the origins of life and that sort of thing. I needed to know their arguments accurately so that I could then assess them, assemble the evidence that I felt showed their arguments were weak, and put it together in a book. If I'd just gone out there and written a book off the top of my head, paying no attention at all to the arguments that my opponents were raising, it would have been a very stupid thing to do. And yet so many people don't bother to research the facts or listen to the other side of the story before they express their opinion, particularly on issues like the ones we're talking about now. And, you know, that's a weakness. I think, you know, again, you go back to the Kahui book controversy from 2011. A Facebook campaign to ban the Maxina King book that I wrote 8 weeks before the book was even finished and published. Nobody knew what was in it. It turned out the book came out with a conclusion that the coroner then said, bang on, you did right. Everybody jumped on the bandwagon, issued an opinion about something they'd never read. It was staggering to me. They weren't even prepared to listen to the other side of the story because they were all so holier than thou and thought that they'd got it all sussed and they'd made their minds up. They knew everything there was to know. Over the course of the weeks of that boycott campaign, I was able to point out to lots of them, your arguments are flawed. You're basing your arguments on old media reports that were out of date and wrong at the time they were published. Because let's face it, journalists only have a limited amount of time to get the story right for a daily newspaper or a radio news broadcast. They don't have the time to go in depth. They're just relying on what a friend of a friend said often, especially when it comes down to police sources. And they don't do a great job. And I had reporters from the New Zealand Herald and Sunday Star Times and other papers writing to me after they read the Breaking Silence book, and they said, we covered the court case of Chris Kahui. We covered the inquest with Maxina King, and we think you did a fantastic job, much better than anything we could have possibly done. We missed a whole lot of leads that we should have picked up on. And that was my colleagues, my peers, telling me after the event that Breaking Silence was a worthwhile book, and they got something from it, and they'd covered the court cases. So again, I guess the point that I'm trying to make is it's really important, regardless of whether people disagree with you or I personally, forget about the person. Listen to the argument. Is the argument logically sound? Is it valid? Do the facts stack up? Do the facts support the conclusions being made? Sure, there's room for debate, but let's have an honest, realistic debate, not a hate session. If we stop listening to each other, we are lost as a society.
It's very similar to a marriage, I guess.
Yeah, it is. It is like that. And you know, again, going back through the great pantheon of books, the great divide on the story of New Zealand's treaty and how it came about was an educational process for me. because we've read so many history books here in New Zealand, you know, Michael King and Claudia Orange and all the rest of them, history books written by scholars, usually getting government grants, and quite sizable government grants, I might add, and they filter the historical documents and information through their own perspectives and their own prejudices. And I'm not saying that to be mean, that's just what humans do, and particularly what historians and scholars do, because that's the expertise that they bring to it. They bring their own view of the world and their own view of their subject to the material. What I did with The Great Divide was to go back into the original source material, the diaries of Captain Cook and the others on the Endeavour, and the original writings of Samuel Marsden and Henry Williams and the early New Zealand settlers and missionaries and so forth. And I looked at what they wrote in terms of their first contact with Māori people. And remembering, of course, that there, although they were European and you can accuse them of being Eurocentric, racism wasn't an issue back then. As far as they were concerned, they were explorers exploring a foreign country and a foreign culture, and New Zealand was just another foreign culture in a long list of foreign cultures that they'd explored. And they were approaching it pretty much from an academic perspective, albeit, you know, one tainted by the social mores of the 1700s. But their accounts were not loaded with the political baggage that the treaty issue is now loaded with. None of that was yet in their gun sights. We have a startlingly honest account of early Māori life in this country. And to tell you the truth, The Great Divide is one of the few books you'll read where that account is actually published. Because when you read Michael King's book, The Penguin History of New Zealand, it's all sanitized out. It's not there. Michael King went and filtered all of the stuff and only gave the readers the stuff that suited his argument. Whereas I just went back to the historical documents for The Great Divide and published them. Plenty of quotes. People can see for themselves what was happening, why the Māori signed the treaty. You know, and getting back to the marriage point, the thing that I learnt from that historical search is that Māori and Pākehā genuinely wanted a union of the races in 1840. And even as late as 1860, there was a huge hui at Kohimarama. 200 chiefs from around the country gathered for it. It was bigger even than the Waitangi treaty signing. And almost to a man, the chiefs all ratified the coming of the British at 1840, the relinquishing of Māori sovereignty. And believe me, they saw it as the relinquishing of sovereignty. They knew they'd given away their sovereignty. They were happy to have done so because for them, there'd been a huge number of benefits in the intervening 20 years. You don't hear that story today. That story has been sanitized out of the history books. You almost cannot find a New Zealand history book that mentions the hui at Kohimarama. So I quoted it chapter and verse in The Great Divide because it showed that there was a real willingness to be a united country back in 1840 and 1860. And we've lost that to an extent now. If we could only learn from our ancestors and learn to talk better and to understand what we each need, then we get along better. I guess that's my point. You know, it doesn't matter what political leaning you come from. I enjoy a good debate. And I hope that people who listen to us can enjoy a good debate.
I concur with that. In fact, the kind of debates that I like the most is when the person I'm debating is correct and I'm wrong, because I get to learn something. And I believe that this is actually an ironic kind of kind of thing for a conspiracy theorist to have, to love being proved wrong. It's just because I don't believe that I'm done learning yet. I'm still young, and quite frankly, my ideas of the world change on a regular basis, and my beliefs are constantly changing. I mean, 2013 Vinny is different from 2014 Vinny. Heck, January Vinny is different from February Vinny. I don't know who I'm going to be tomorrow.
It's called following where the evidence leads, and it's something that I think everyone should do. If somebody came along tomorrow and made an outstanding case for human-caused climate change and published the scientific information which was convincing over and above the information that says it's not human-caused, I would change my opinion on climate change, because to do otherwise would be to deny reality.
Yes.
But I haven't seen that evidence. I'm prepared to change my mind if someone convinces me, likewise, on the existence of God. I didn't choose Christianity for a feel-good factor by becoming a Christian. I chose Christianity because I'd begun as an atheist. I'd gnashed my teeth and wailed against that. I eventually came to the conclusion I can't deny the existence of a creator because there's no other rational explanation for the world, unless you go down fairy tale theories like multiple universes, which we can't ever prove scientifically, which is just another, effectively, a religious belief as well, but it's just one that renames God and calls him a multiverse instead of God. So I made a decision for Christianity on an intellectual basis, and the spiritual stuff followed. But if someone was to make a compelling case that Christianity was untrue, in other words, you know, they dug up the body of Jesus somewhere and he hadn't been resurrected, of course I'd have to change my mind. It would only be rational to do so. Mm. I don't expect that to happen because it hasn't happened yet. And there's plenty of good evidence that he was resurrected. But, you know, the point that I'm making is we should always retain our intellects and our ability to judge the evidence, and we should be prepared to change our minds. We shouldn't be wedded to being liberal or conservative or whatever the particular flavor or tag of the day is just because we want to be part of the pack. If you want to be part of the pack, you know, you've come to the wrong show. This is a show, the Ian Wishart show, is a show for independent thinkers, and I think the Vinnie Eastwood show probably is as well.
Yeah, totally. I was talking about my demographics. I was looking through them, Ian, and turns out, I'm 29 years old. My average listener is between the age of 40 and 62, right? These are people who have gone through their life. They have worked, and they have come to this conclusion on their own, and many of them have not at any one point swallowed the propaganda and the mind control that the system puts upon them. And I think many of them have been waiting for this day that shows like ours can even exist, because previously there was no other real options. I mean, thank God for the internet. You know, I don't think God invented it, but still.
That's right. I mean, it is. It's really important in this independent. But again, people need to support it. They need to listen. They need to be prepared to tick the boxes and say, yeah, we do listen. We do support this. We see the need for this sort of independent media coverage of things, because the mainstream media are doing a shocking job. Sadly, so many people believe the mainstream media. And I was part of the mainstream media. That was how I made my daily bread. But I was never dumb enough to sit there and think that my fellow journalists were doing, you know, the absolute best job they possibly could. I mean, they're good, honest people, but they're still people with a perspective. And if they've been brought up in a particular way, if they've been educated in a particular way, if they've been taught to be journalists in a particular way, that will filter through, and that's what you're seeing. I mentioned a moment ago about people being blinded to what's coming to them. You know, these are not the droids you're looking for. There's so much an element of that in our media coverage these days. Particularly our TV coverage, the reporters are prepared to take the words of officials at face value, and they have no questioning of them. I remember at the end of the Winebox court appeal process, Court of Appeal came out and basically overturned the Winebox inquiry judgment and said, you know, these transactions were fraud, and there is room for prosecution. And I remember Bill Birch, who was treasurer at the time, being interviewed on News Talk ZB. And he was interviewed and he said to them, oh, this court judgment's a load of rubbish and blah, blah, blah. And there was no attempt in the ZB interview to challenge Bill Birch on any of the mistaken comments that he was making. So he was actually, you know, incorrectly stating the facts as he gave this interview. And I rang up ZB and I spoke to the reporter concerned. I said, why didn't you challenge him? And he said, oh, I'm just a reporter. I'm not allowed to question these people. What? Hello? That's what we're here for.
It's like, what's the job description? What's the job description? It's to ask questions.
Exactly.
Nothing for mercy.
So, no, that's the problem we face.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, have you ever said two very ironic things in a row? You know, like one of the people in this Kiwi Journalist Association said, Vinny, you're a conspiracy nutter. Crackpot alert in full capitals, and then accused me of insulting people using ad hominem attacks and trolling. Like, I'm not sure which came first.
Good, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I love screenshotting stuff like that. You know, it's brilliant. I've got folders on my computer just full of this insane abuse. I don't know why I keep collecting it. Maybe it just amuses me. You know, like or maybe I have some kind of sick fascination, like the way an African warlord would collect trophies of his kill or something of that nature. I don't know, but still,
exactly. Maybe you'll be stuffed and mounted and put on your own wall.
What? Don't think my wall's big enough, but, you know, I'm 6'4", Ian, you know.
Sprig of parsley and an apple in your mouth.
You know, I'm just born to not fit into this world. I'm sorry. In fact, we had a realization the other day, how some people find it actually really difficult to say certain things. They find it really difficult to speak up in a crowd. They find it difficult to apologize or admit that they're wrong or anything. I really don't have any of that, you know. I mean, for me to say sorry is just as easy for me to say hi to somebody. You know, it's like, hi, I'm Vinny, and I'm sorry.
Shall I share with you some of the the tastier bits of Totalitaria when we come back?
I think we will.
I've just got to take a quick break, and we'll be back soon.
Somewhere out there in the vast nothingness of space. Somewhere far away in space and time. Staring upward at the gleaming stars in the obsidian sky. We're marooned on a small island in an endless sea. Confined to a tiny spit of sand, unable to escape. But tonight, on this small planet, on Earth, we're going to rock civilization.
Hi, I'm Ian Wishart. This is live365.com and the Ian Wishart Show. And we're also simulcasting with Vinny Eastwood from the Vinny Eastwood Show. Vinny, good evening again.
Good evening again.
Yes.
Does the evening get any better if you say that it's good twice?
Probably gets twice as good.
You never know. We'll hypothesize on that. All right.
Yeah, what I was going to do is going to share with your listeners a little bit about Totalitaria. In terms of some of the juicier bits, one of the things I discovered in that book was that, did you know, for example, about the meditation room in the UN?
I heard, no, I didn't really hear anything about it because apparently it's a silent meditation room.
Very good answer. I'm sure most of your listeners will be unaware. The United Nations claims to be a secular organization. And you would think so. It's a parliament of the world, right? However, there's a twist. The United Nations, when it was set up for spiritual reasons as much as natural reasons, because they saw in 1944-45 the only way of preventing world horrors like World War II was to unite mankind under one flag. And the only way to do that was to create a new spirituality, a new world religion. So that was part of the driving force behind the establishment of the United Nations in 1945, and that's available on the UN website, that claim. The second Secretary General of the United Nations, Dag Hammarskjöld, was a Swedish guy in the 1950s. He lasted about 10 years in the job before he died in a plane crash in the Congo. But one of his key acts was to establish what he called a meditation room directly under the UN debating chamber. Now, most people are totally unaware of this and what it is. He brought in the world's largest piece of iron ore, what's officially known as magnetite. The largest piece of iron ore ever mined. It was 6.5 tons. He had it specially cut in the form of an iron ore altar. Of all things, an altar. 5 feet high, 2 feet wide, 6 feet long, bit like a coffin, except a big, you know, imagine the stone table on in the Narnia film Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, and you get the impression. And he built this room directly under the UN debating chamber in the shape of a truncated pyramid to a very particular occult plan, according again to a document available through one of the UN NGOs. And it was all very specially constructed. In fact, he would make visits at 2 o'clock in the morning during construction. It took a year and a half to construct, to make sure that the lighting was exactly the way it should be at that precise time of the night. And the whole thing was done very, very specially. He gave custody of the UN meditation room across to a crowd called the Lucis Trust. And people can Google that if they want. But I detail all this in the book. The Lucis Trust were affiliated with what was known once as the Lucifer Publishing Company. And the name should be a clue to people, Lucifer. It was set up by Alice Bailey, who was one of the disciples of Theosophy and Helena Blavatsky. And it was this secret society that hatched the plan to take over the world. Or, in fact, they're the ones who managed to effectively carry it through. Bailey and Blavatsky's disciples included Dag Hammarskjöld. They also included the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, Dr. Robert Mueller. Mueller was one of those who set up UNESCO. He was instrumental in setting up the World Environment, the UN Environment Program, and a range of other big programs. But he, too, was a follower of Theosophy and the Lucifer Publishing Company. The altar in the United Nations building, to cut a long story short, is dedicated to Lucifer. And for those who don't know, Lucifer is Satan. Of all the things you'd expect to find in the United Nations, an altar to Satan is not one of them. But there it is. Smack bang, there's a photograph in the book. There are photographs online of the UN meditation room if you want to take a look at it. Why would there be such a thing in the UN building? Then when you read the writings of these guys at the heads of the UN and you see their agenda for the planet and what they wanted to roll out, it makes the prickles on the back of your neck stand up. It really does. And as I said, you know, it doesn't matter whether you believe in this stuff. It matters that they believe in this stuff. Now, you'd think that perhaps this might have died out with the guy who died in the plane crash, but sadly, no. The next Secretary General of the United Nations, his successor, a guy named Hugh Thont, was also mysteriously a follower of Alice Bailey. And again, a key player in this altar to Lucifer in the United Nations. And he was instrumental in inviting across Pope Paul VI to become the first Roman Catholic Pope to ever address the United Nations. The day was October 4, 1965. The news articles about that are available online in newspaper archives. You have to pay for access to them, but they're there. And we've quoted and photographed some of them in the book. Pope Paul VI went downstairs underneath the General Assembly building with Hugh Thont, and he prayed at the altar to Lucifer. The head of the Roman Catholic Church prayed at an altar to Satan. He then, in his General Assembly speech, pledged the Roman Catholic Church's loyalty to the United Nations and everything it stood for. He then gave Hugh Thont his papal rings and symbols of authority as a gesture of goodwill. The symbolism of that is stark. Did the church, the Roman Catholic Church, on October 4, 1965, do a deal with the devil? Spooky stuff. Read the book. It's interesting, though, because are you aware of Father Malachi Martin?
Nope.
Never heard of him.
No.
He's written books like The Keys to This Blood. He's a best-selling, or was a best-selling author. He died in very controversial circumstances about 10 years ago in the US. He was pushed, never recovered from falling downstairs, and his manuscript for his final book went missing. But he was a Vatican insider. He was an advisor to one of the popes. And he published details of what he alleged was a black mass, a satanic mass in the Vatican, around the time that Pope Paul VI was enthroned. Now, Malachi Martin wasn't aware of the Buin Meditation Room and its significance, and he wasn't aware, I don't think, of what happened when Paul VI went and prayed there. But it all fits with what Malachi Martin later wrote and what another cardinal came out with in 1996 and said that there were still satanic masses taking place inside the Catholic Church. Now, again, it doesn't matter whether you listening believe in this sort of stuff or not. What matters is that the people doing it believe. And so you have the United Nations, its only religious symbol in the entire building is an altar dedicated to Lucifer. Ask yourself the significance of that. Read the book if you want the full details. I mean, we could have a debate about that for years to come, but I've laid it out. The documents are all there. It's fascinating stuff. I sit there scratching my head, and I've asked the question in the book. If anybody can give me a rational explanation as to how this sort of stuff happens, I'm hoping to hear it. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, it'd be nice, wouldn't it? You know, you ever wonder, I don't know, one day if you woke up and it turns out that actually we were crazy, like everybody else was right, everybody else was right the whole time, we were totally wrong. Like oh, nice, thank goodness, there isn't a bunch of ruthless criminals, satanic, sociopathic, child molesting, human trafficking, murdering, psychopathic, pedophile scum running the entire world. That's a great weight off my mind.
Wouldn't it be great? But you couldn't make this stuff up. But get this, another thing that's in the book as well. The United Nations has its World Heritage Sites. You're familiar with those? UNESCO does them. New Zealand's got a couple of ones listed in the World Heritage Site, right?
Yeah, there's one on Waiheke Island. I think the whole of Waiheke is a World Heritage Site or something.
It is the Waiheke Island, it is. But one of the sites that they've chosen for the United Nations World Heritage Sites is a place called Lumbini. And Lumbini is the reputed birthplace of Buddha. Except the United Nations calls him Lord Buddha. But there are some thousand or more documents in the UNESCO files with the title Lord Buddha. But just for sake of balance, I was just curious to check it out. Now, you'll know what I'm about to say. I did a Google search in the United Nations files for anything saying Lord Jesus and found nothing. There's not a single document. But anyway, the twist to the story is that Lumbini has a reference number. It has an assigned number in the United Nations system. Would you care to guess what that number is?
It's 666 or 33.
You got it in one. 666. Yeah, you couldn't make this stuff up. You really couldn't. And it's fascinating because it ties into the whole Helena Blavatsky thing, because one of the things she did, and this will be I'm sure you'll have some of the Buddhists listening to you spitting tacks right now. But again, I can't apologize for the truth, but here it is. Helena Blavatsky heard from some spirit guides in 1875 who said to her, the coming one, the absolute supreme, is returning to Earth and you need to go and spread the news and prepare the way. And the spirits told her to go to Sri Lanka, or what was then known as Ceylon, which was the last remaining stronghold of Buddhism in the world. Buddhism had been wiped out on the Indian mainland and in most of the Asian continent by the various governments that had been in power, and the Muslims in particular didn't like it. So Buddhism was very, very much on its last legs. It was an almost extinct religion outside of Ceylon. There are a few isolated pockets in Japan, but not much. Blavatsky went across to Ceylon with her co-founder of Theosophy, and they rewrote Buddhism, and they incorporated a whole lot of new occult, Western occult ideas into Buddhism. And they very much pitched it as one of enlightenment and various levels of enlightenment and initiation and so on. And they then sent their disciples out from the Buddhist monasteries in Ceylon to the rest of Asia and take it to Thailand and Burma and Japan and China and so forth and India, and reacquaint the world with Buddhism. If you actually look, and I did this in the book, and I've cited the scholarly studies, there are academic scholars who've studied the history of Buddhism, and they're very clear and matter-of-fact in their announcement. They say that modern Buddhism, as you know it, is not authentic. The Buddhism that you strike in New Zealand or the United States or Asia or Thailand or Burma or wherever is not authentic, original Buddhism. It is based entirely on the Blavatsky, Satanistic, Luciferian plot. And they've made that point in the academic study groups and reports. So yeah. You have this group, and they've not only infiltrated the United Nations, they've infiltrated various world religions, Catholicism and Protestant evangelical churches and Buddhism. They've got control of virtually every belief system in the world. It's staggering stuff.
Mm. It's like diet Buddhism, or I can't believe it's not Buddhism.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those stories that it's the Matrix. It takes you down the rabbit hole and says, "Well, what do you want to find out?" And that's why I think it's shaking people up. But it's important because if we don't face up to these truths and get to grips with where it's come from, you know, we will never have the answers to it. It's only those people who are truly informed who can make informed decisions. That's my view of the world.
Well, I think that's actually pretty straightforward. Like, only people with legs can walk. And
true. Only fish with wings can fly.
Yeah. And the other element that we need to actually look into here is also the corruption of virtually everything that it is to be human. I mean, what have we got? We've got those three aspects. There's the physical, the mental, and the spiritual. And I think the New World Order has been so adept at having physical influences, mental influences, and spiritual influences circling around everybody at all the time. If even one of those hooks gets you, if one of the physical influences, like be they perhaps a thimerosal mercury in the vaccines or something like that, causes autism, boom, they've got you. Or if there is a false religion, like the New Age religion, boom, they've got you. Or if there is a logical fallacy kind of thing, like believing in mainstream politics to a large degree and thinking that those politicians are actually the rulers of your country, they've got you. Mm. It comes to the point where it's actually a miracle. One might even say divine providence that we've woken up to this fact at all.
Yeah, it is. But it brings with it its own baggage because, you know, the people involved in this have put a lot of planning and effort into their plan to control the world, and they've come very close to it. I mean, you look at the New Zealand NCEA education exams, right? Most people won't be aware that our NCEA education exams are based on the World Core Curriculum of the United Nations. The World Core Curriculum of the United Nations was written by Robert Mueller, the aforementioned follower of Helena Blavatsky and her satanistic beliefs. And he was firmly wedded to these and the belief that they needed to capture kids in the education system to prepare them for the New World Order. So our exam system is based on the education policies of these mad fruit bats. And that, I think, is something that you know, people should focus on. Your kids are being trained and indoctrinated and taught. And you possibly, if you're listening and you're young enough, have been trained and taught to think in this way. And to you, it seems absolutely normal. But if you know who the people are who are pulling your strings and rattling your chain, you're better placed to wake up and start, you know, readjusting your thinking. But if you're never warned about this, you'll never get that chance.
It is said that a person needs to hear the same thing seven times by seven different people. You can't tell the same person the same thing seven times and have them get it. It has to be seven different people saying the same thing. And I think this is why people in this truth movement, as it's been called, are experiencing a lot of frustration and pain as a result of going out and attempting to quote-unquote wake people up, is because they think that they can do it alone. And they get remarkably disappointed and mistakenly give up entirely on waking people up and hold a pin on their fellow man and think, oh, nobody can be saved. There's no gonna... Look, it ain't all your responsibility. All you got to do is play your part and hope that six other people play theirs. That's all it is. Don't put the whole world on your shoulders.
It is about passing it forward and hoping that things go viral. I mean, one of the issues with our book is that people were ringing up and buying 10 copies at a time because as so many people spoke to me on the phone, they said, look, all this is in paper that I've been concerned about for years. I've suspected. You know, the conspiracy websites, they make these sort of claims, but they don't really provide any hard evidence. And you've gone and nailed it back down to the original source documents. We love you for it. I'll take 10 copies, please. And each one of those people is paying it forward. They're effectively giving the gift of knowledge, if you like, to their mates and their family and friends and so forth. And the idea goes viral. So you're right. Those people are having other people come to them and dump books on them. I saw a book review in Australia. Totally unexpected. Somebody had gone and bought the reviewer a copy of Totalitaria in Perth and dumped it on them. And the reviewer ended up giving the book 6 stars out of a possible 5, which I was grateful for, as you would be as a struggling author. But this is the point. Until people read it and hear it and understand it, the context isn't there. And, you know, even this radio show or my own radio show, we can't really cover in a radio broadcast the nuances and the evidence that people need to really get their heads around some of this stuff. And a lot of the stuff you do and I do, because it's too complex. All we can do is draw attention to it and say, look, the information's out there. But people at the end of the day have to get off their backsides and read it. Because only when they've seen the evidence for themselves with their own eyes will they believe.
Now, there's a number of different media apparatus that are being used. Now, I'm sure you realize as well as I do, Ian, that one of the best methodologies of brainwashing is to infiltrate the media, right? You know?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how anybody could...
I'm not sure brainwashing is the right word, though. There'd have to be brains in place in the first place to do it.
Granted. but the point here is, it's about, I think actually what I had to realize about what my chosen career is now, I guess it's kind of not much of a choice, rather a lack of options, is I'm a counter propaganda warfare agent, more or less. Would you see yourself in such a way, to a degree, considering who your enemy is ignorance, you know?
I get accused of being a counter propaganda warfare agent. Look, you know, we both, all of us have a role to play. And at the end of the day, we can't, as I said earlier, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. All we can do is offer the evidence and say, look, this needs further investigation, or here is the evidence, it's absolutely clear. One of the things with me in my brand of journalism is I'm not afraid to stand up and fly against the current if that's where the evidence is taking me, even though it might make me seriously unpopular. Look, I'm as aware as the next person. It'd be far easier for me to take the easy road and to give people what they want and expect to hear. I'd be a rich man if I did that. But I couldn't live with myself. And that's the truth of it. You know, as I said in the Kahui case, it would have been so easy for me to interview Maxina King and then do a hatchet job on her and paint her in the worst possible light and give the public, the baying public for blood, what they wanted. I would have sold 50,000 copies of that book if I'd done that. But I couldn't live with myself for doing that because it wasn't right. It wasn't the truth. All we can do is try and battle the propaganda, as you so correctly put it,
well,
unceasingly.
Yeah. It's kind of like a protracted war. And these secret societies that you have exposed in your book in Totalitaria Ad Nauseam, one in particular that I'd like to discuss is the Fabian Socialists. These are some very, very dangerous ideologies that are coming up, and I know that we're coming to the end of the show in about less than 10 minutes, aren't we, Ian?
Close to it.
Okay. Well, for those who are unaware of what Fabian Socialism is, there's two symbols that I've seen, sigils, if you will, that symbolise Fabian Socialism that they've actually adopted for themselves. The first being a tortoise with a hammer. The philosophy behind that meaning they very, very, very slowly move towards you, and just when they're right next to you, wham, they get you with the hammer. The other symbol for Fabian Socialism is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Now, Fabian Socialism in New Zealand, I've looked up this, and you should see all the left-wing journalists and bloggers and things of this nature who like them on Facebook.
Yeah, you know? It is shocking. And it is I talk in Totalitaria about what I call a convergence of opportunities. And what I mean by that is that the principle of globalization is welcomed by different groups for different reasons. They share a common cause. And we're at this perfect storm moment in history whereby you have politicians who believe in globalization for political power, predominantly those of the left, but sometimes those of the right. There are business corporations and global corporations who believe in globalization for the sake of market efficiencies and making maximum profits by conducting their affairs in countries with the cheapest labor and the lowest regulations. There are lobby groups and charities who believe in globalization and world government because they stand to gain contracts out of that, and they see it as politically acceptable for them and the missions that they're trying to accomplish. And you just look at the climate change bandwagon and the lobby groups and charities that are involved in that, making billions off it. And then there are spiritual globalists, and they are the people we've talked about in Totalitarian as well, the Helena Blavatskys and the theosophists of this world, who believe they are ushering in world government to bring in the coming one, in short, Satan. They call him Satan. And they have spiritual reasons for globalization, but nonetheless, they all share a common cause. And so these groups join together loosely in various forms and work towards this common cause, and they adopt various aspects of their belief systems as they need to in order to move forward together on various things. And so you get this tie-in between big business and New Age evangelization and environmental causes. There's a massive tie-up. And if people want to know what this is like, go and look at the money earned by Greenpeace worldwide and Oxfam and Worldwide Fund for Nature and so forth off donations since Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth. They have made billions in donations by scaring the public about climate change. There is money to be mined in these mines, and they are doing it left, right, and center. It's extremely cynical. I mean, the reason Greenpeace does some of the things that it does. I put this on the record. I was a Greenpeace donor for years, for about a decade, after the Rainbow Warrior bombing. But I eventually became wary of the politicization and the propaganda that was taking place, because I was working in TV3 and we would be fed these Greenpeace videos that they'd taken themselves from Lord knows where. And they were regularly feeding material into the news networks and effectively manipulating the news coverage of various events. Good on them for doing it. It's just propaganda 101. But I suddenly realized that they were tying all these campaigns into the media releases into their donation campaigns. And they'd start running TV ads calling for donations on the back of them. And I realized that these charities are making massive amounts of money, and it's non-taxable, or was non-taxable, because of their charitable status at the time. So everybody in this world is making money one way, shape, or form. It's just that a lot of them are saying we're doing it for altruistic reasons, and they're hoodwinking the public. So I think it's, you know, incumbent on all of us to sort of look at the motivations and so forth. And this convergence of opportunities explains why the Fabian Socialists, you know, there's a group called Socialist International, and Helen Clark is a senior figure in that group. Mm-hmm. And they have a clear pathway to world government. They're an advisor to the United Nations. They've written an exploratory paper for the UN on achieving global governance and what has to happen to do that within the next 10 years. Now, their plan dovetails with the Theosophy plan as well. But Theosophy is providing the ideological, spiritual aspect of it and the control of the public through education and belief systems. Socialists are providing the framework and the governance mechanism, the politicization of it. So all of these different groups are working in concert, and that's what I'm trying to explore in the book. I mean, the book is not just about, you know, devil worshipping nutcases and fruit bats. It's also about the Edward Snowden issue, the surveillance that's going on. And the point that I make there is that people may have, in the mainstream public, no problem with surveillance on Islamic terrorism. But the problem is this. If we agree to the level of surveillance that's going on in our private lives on the premise of combating terrorism, that infrastructure will stay in place forever. And when it comes to the new regime, they'll suddenly have infrastructure in their hands that is capable of quelling dissent very rapidly. And so those same people who welcome it today for a narrow purpose won't be so happy with it in 10 years' time when it's used against them.
Yep. It's the old adage, what was that, the guy who was quoting, you know, first they came for the Jews, but I didn't stand up because I wasn't Jewish, and so on and so forth. And I think these people have figured out quite a brilliant plan. I mean, you got to hand it to them, Ian. They've well thought it out. They've well planned. However, what I've found about the lesson of history is even the best formed plans that have been protracted over many, many long periods of time can be messed up in very, very short periods of time significantly by individuals. Like, you know, it's actually pretty straightforward. Part of the great thing about being human is that we're endowed with immense quantities of power. I'm not talking about like, oh, it's just a little bit of power, you know, only a few people can do a few things or whatever. I'm talking about unfathomable, like you don't have any idea how much courage you have until it takes X amount of courage to survive what you're going through. You don't know how strong you are until your strength has been tested. And I think what has happened to society is that we've been wrapped in bubble wrap for so long that we think we still need it, both for our minds and our bodies. We don't.
Yeah, well, this is the whole nanny state argument that you go back 100 years when nanny state didn't exist and you had to survive on your own. People were tougher, much tougher than they are now. Today, we expect the government, the state, to do everything for us, cradle to the grave almost. And we whine and we whinge and we complain when the state doesn't provide the various services we think we're entitled to. The risk of that, I mean, sure, we can go providing entitlements to everybody till the cows come home, but the risk of that is that we effectively dumb ourselves down. Not only that, we enter into a contract with the state where we sell our souls. And that's what's happening. But the state feels it can have more and more and more and more control of your life because it's paying more and more and more money to look after you. And that's the paradigm. That's the contradiction that we have to face.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think, what was it? My two favorite pieces of advice I was given by Jack Bloody's American talk radio show host, has been talking about this kind of stuff that we've been talking about for like 15 years, Ian. And when you're going into it, you will often find out that it's quite difficult, and the road is long and hard, and you've got to maintain some sort of a sense of balance. So I asked him how you did that. How did you do this for 15 years and still maintain on an even keel and not turn into some form of douchebag? He says, number one, drink. If I didn't drink, I would have gone frickin' nuts. Number two, take the money. If you're not doing anything, if you're not doing anything evil, if you're actually doing the right thing, and people offer you money, and they're not asking you to compromise what it is that you're doing, just take the money.
Exactly. Well, if people want to support me, they're welcome to. I'll take as much money as they can give. Seriously though, they can get the books that I've talked about at Amazon.com or IanWishart.com. It's easy enough. And ebooks, they're available instantly. So I really urge people to read the material that's there, particularly in Totalitaria, because it's an eye-opening thing. It's getting great reviews across America and Australia. The reason I've done the book is primarily to wake people up and to give them the evidence that they need to say, here comes the New World Order. This is what we need to be watching out for. It's not happening by accident. It's happening by design. And if you realize what the plan is and how it may affect your life, then you'll be much better placed to try and sidestep it.
Mm. Did you think about turning it into an audiobook? Because as soon as I started reading it, I was like, man, I would love to read this out as an audiobook.
It's funny, you know, I gave a speech last night and people made the comment after I gave my presentation, you know, the book really came alive. It'd make a fantastic movie, but no one would believe it. it's just staggering. But it's, you know, if you've read it, the book is based on fact. It's all there. It's all nailed down. It comes down to whether you believe these people have the abilities that they claim they have, but nonetheless, they're in positions of power. They're running the United Nations. And the United Nations came very, very close in 2009 to imposing a global government through the climate change debate at Copenhagen, the treaty there. They missed out because they were sprung about 2 weeks beforehand, and the American media publicized the plan for a world government clause in the Copenhagen Treaty, and it got ditched. But the UN is coming back for another bite in 2015, next year. They're gearing up for what they call a major planetary announcement on sustainability goals that will impose a governance structure to achieve sustainability. And you know what? The one thing I found out from Totalitarian researching and writing it is that I once believed that nobody would fall for the New World Order because they'd know what it represented and all of the drama associated with it. What I found since writing the book is that the public, a large amount of the public, are begging for the New World Order to come. They genuinely are begging for it, and they don't understand what they're begging for, but they've been conditioned to believe it so much they're like sheep bleating in the distance in the paddocks for mummy. And these are the people I'm trying to reach.
You know what this reminds me of? A film called, what was it, Captain America, the First Avenger. And he was talking about Red Skull. He wanted to, like, bomb, all of his enemies. And it was like, his enemies, not Germany's enemies, his enemies. And he could bomb pretty much everything. And the American captain was going, don't you think that that's a really crazy plan, though? Because you'll destroy the whole world. And his assistant goes, the consequence of the plan is of no consequence. He goes, why? Because he can do it. Yeah,
it's the way it is.
Yeah, you know, it's a shame, but hey, look at it this way. At least, even if I were to die tomorrow, be exterminated by jackboot thug or whatever, I'd be like, at least I didn't sit around and do absolutely nothing. What's everybody else's excuse? Come on, it feels good to expose scumbaggery. Expose it, I say.
Exactly. This is Ian Wishart, live365.com, and Vinny Eastwood on the Vinny Eastwood Show. Vinny, it's been great talking to you today, and thanks for your company, and we'll be replaying this live on the Ian Wishart Show on live365.com through the week as well.
Fantastic. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen, and also bear in mind the Vinny Eastwood Show is a listener-supported broadcast. If you would like to go and support me in the work that I do, getting out all of these voices that the mainstream media will either censor entirely or not give enough time to explain their ideas in full, go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead. Make my news. And make a donation today, or a regular donation, preferably into the Kiwi Bank, because PayPal always takes a percentage, and we all know how much I don't like giving the New World Order a percentage. Thank you very much. We'll see you again sometime, folks.